Hi, and welcome to the Sexy Aging Podcast. I'm Tracy Monoknuku, a midlifer, menopausal, and at the juncture of life where I decided that I was going to kick over my bucket list, starting with this podcast. Since then, I've written a book, My Menopause Memoir, set up a website to support women through the menopause transition, developed an online course for menopause, and thrown my passion for fitness and wellness into an app specifically made for women in midlife and menopause. I also love delivering workshops virtually and in person to support women in the workplace when it comes to, you guessed it, menopause. If you're interested in finding out more about these projects, I've added the links in my bio, and I offer podcast listener discounts in the show notes just for you, so check those out. As an indie podcaster, that means that no one is paying me to produce this podcast. I want to bring you relevant, interesting, and engaging guests. By following and sharing the podcast with others, I can continue to make the podcast episodes and give you more of what you want to listen to. So let's crack on with today's interview. Eleanor Mills and the word queenager are reverently spoken in one breath. Eleanor has a lengthy background in journalism as the editorial director for the Sunday Times and was an award-winning editor of the Sunday Times magazine in the UK. Eleanor has many accolades and shares that this is her Q3 as the editor-in-chief of Noon, a new platform for women in midlife dedicated to challenging gendered ageism, changing the cultural narrative about the latest stages of women's lives, and helping brands connect with this underserved but lucrative cohort. I had the pleasure of asking questions shared by the Menopause Collective New Zealand, a group of powerhouse women pushing through the narrative on menopause support for women in New Zealand. A reminder that you can participate in this conversation by sharing your opinions and thoughts via the Spotify app. At the end of each episode is a question related to the interview. I'd love to hear your thoughts. And so having you on the Sexy Aging Podcast is a real honour, Eleanor. So thank you very much for saying yes.
Oh, it's a great pleasure to be here. So good to be joining you from London.
Yeah. So tell us, obviously you've been a writer and an editor and in journalism for a long time and then moved across to Noon. So there's a story there. So how about we go back a little bit? Tell us how you got into the writing and into journalism and doing what you're doing today, which feels incredibly purposeful for you.
Yeah, it's definitely very purposeful. So I run a platform called Noon, as in the middle of the day, .org.uk, because in the 100-year life, I think 50 is only halfway through. And I was a very senior editor in the British media for a quarter of a century. I was a top journalist at a newspaper called the Sunday Times. I edited its magazine. I was its editorial director. And I was also chair of the UK's organisation Women in Journalism. So I've had a pretty front row seat on the mainstream media. And I say that not to brag, but because it gave me a real insight into what is covered and what isn't covered and how it's covered. And what I really love about running my own media company now, which is all about women in midlife, as you rightly say, I call them queenagers, is that I no longer have to run all my ideas or anything that I think is interesting through a whole kind of phalanx of more senior men. And that is an absolute kind of revelation for me every day. So when you say that I feel purposeful, I feel really purposeful because I think that there's such an important conversation to be had. I'm really interested in kind of women 45 to 65. What my friend Aviva Wittenberg-Cox, who's a great thinker in this area, calls Q3, which is this kind of new bit of our lives. Because as that lifespan extends, the old model of, you know, maybe getting educated, kind of we used to think we'd get educated, we'd do a job for a long time and then we'd retire. Mm-hmm. And of course, that just doesn't work anymore. I worked somewhere for nearly 25 years, but that makes me almost a freak amongst my friends. I mean, no one really works that long for the same company anymore. So yeah. The idea that in a 100-year life, you're going to kind of get educated and have one job and then retire, that's just not going to happen. And what I think is really interesting about this 50-year-old kind of what I see as a kind of midlife pivot is that this new chunk of time between about 50 and 75, where we're still healthy, we're still, you know, those of us who've been working have got some resources, and actually it's a whole new bit of life. If you think you're probably not going to die till you're kind of maybe in your 90s or your late 80s or something, there's a whole kind of healthy bit of purposeful life which nobody's really thought about. And so what I'm really interested in is how we come into our prime at that part of our lives, that we're not kind of old and past it and had it, which is kind of what the mainstream media likes to kind of say about women of 50. That actually, what I see around me, all these incredible women, is they're just coming into their prime. We feel like we're just getting going. So the point about Queenager was, we did a big piece of research at Noon, the biggest study so far into women 45 to 65. So this isn't just my pontification, this comes from really interesting data. And that really showed that there is a real sense in these women that they are, you know, they've never had more experience, they've never felt kind of more confident about themselves. And yet there's a massive discrepancy between how they feel and how they look and what they're doing and the mainstream narrative that is told about them. So part of the reason I set up my own platform is to see the world from a Queenager point of view, not through the male lens, which is most of the media. So yeah. I really began to see, as chair of Women in Journalism, that so much of the way women are taught to think about themselves comes through a media which is not a truly straight reflecting mirror of what's going on, but it's like a refracting lens, it's a distorting lens, because women are always seen through the viewpoint of a kind of a whole load of old posh men, basically white men in the UK. Yeah. And that is not terribly helpful in terms of what we're valued for or what we're judged for. There was a big thing always when I was on the newspaper, which was about they'd say something like, oh love, brighten up the page,
and oh that my meant god
put in a picture of a pretty girl. So if women are basically seen as a way of brightening up a page, then once you get to a point where the male lens knows, no longer thinks you're kind of fanciable or fecund, which is the two things that the patriarchy really values women for, we become very marginalized and kind of ignored. And so everything that I'm trying to do at Noon is to put the wisdom of the kind of older woman back at the center of that conversation, because I think it's incredibly important, not just in terms of how we feel about ourselves, but also about how younger women feel about themselves and this ridiculous sense that maybe they've got a kind of sell-by date, or there's a kind of runway. Yeah. Or that really annoying trope in our culture that men age like fine wine, you know, the kind of silver foxes, whereas women are seen as peaches, you know, one wrinkle and you're done. So we don't like that.
No, we don't.
Everything I'm doing is really trying to counter that narrative.
Yeah, I am having so many little ping, ping, ping moments of so much of what you've said. It resonates with me. And I have a question for you too. But I just want to say, like, I worked in the fitness industry for 30 years and I never saw anything that represented me as I was going into sort of my late 40s. And then, of course, you know, doubting that I was going to bring any worth anymore, and having so much doubt around, you know, have I expired? And the fitness industry will do that to you because it's a youthified industry, right? So it's very hard to find people that look like me. I'm pretty fit, so that's okay. I look after myself and I represent that core woman in their 50s who take their health and fitness quite seriously. But 90% are not seeing that and feel like they couldn't walk into a gym and get something that worked for them. Their workouts aren't targeted to them. They're too high impact and we're going to pee our pants and all the rest of the stuff that happens with that. Right. But one of the things that you said that just made me think was there a pivotal moment when you were working previously that you thought, I can't do this anymore?
I think it was more of a kind of creeping realization. So I think the moment where I really decided, I just had a very strong sense that I had to do something new, is I went to Jamaica and I went and took some magic mushrooms on a retreat.
Well, I've got ayahuasca on my bucket list, so high five there.
Yeah, high five from England on the psychedelics. So in Jamaica, it's legal. And at the time, I was the editor of the Sunday Times magazine. And one of my reporters, an amazing woman called Decca Aikenhead, who spends a lot of time in Jamaica, wanted to go and try out this psilocybin retreat.
Yeah.
Because she'd had very bad PTSD. Her husband had drowned in front of her and her children years before. She's written a book about that, so I'm not speaking out of turn. And she really wanted to try and process that trauma. And there's a lot of amazing research from John Hopkins University and stuff which was saying that psilocybin is actually a really good way of getting out of set patterns and kind of resetting the brain. So she came to me, she's also a great friend. So she came to me and said, I want to go to Jamaica and take magic mushrooms. And I said, as her editor, well, I think I have a duty of care if you're going to go and take magic mushrooms in Jamaica.
Of course you do, yeah.
So I was like, yeah, great idea, but I'm going to come with you. So we went together. That was quite an interesting one to get past the top brass, but we did manage to get to do it. And so we went out to Jamaica and we did 3 big doses of psilocybin in a week. And this isn't microdosing. This is like,
the full one. Yeah. Okay.
This is the full one. This is the kind of ego dissolution kind of, you know, the full thing. So, and I went out really as a kind of, as a bit of a spectator, because I also knew we were going to be churning up a lot of stuff for her. So there was a duty of care there too. But it was also for me really life transforming, in that I just had this real, I had a real vision, actually, while not on the psilocybin, that that my career as I'd known it had ended. I had this moment where I just blew it all up, and that I really wanted to do something else. And that what I wanted to do was to help people transform into something new at this point. And it was an incredibly powerful week, because I saw around me a lot of older men, actually, who were really like kind of dried up husks. They'd kind of done everything that society had told them was going to make them kind of happy and successful. They were all like lawyers or, you know, Silicon Valley financiers. They'd all made an absolute killing. And they were so unhappy. They were kind of really like, it felt like they hadn't had a feeling for about 50 years. And the psilocybin really opened them up. And so I could see this incredible transformation that came when people kind of lent into just kind of really opening themselves up to a new experience at that point in their kind of midlife, in their 50s, in their 60s. And the transformation was incredible. There was one guy who'd arrived saying that he was going to sue his, he was suing his partner, he was suing his ex-wife. He was like really bitter. And by the end of the week, he'd given up all his legal actions, decided that he'd been the problem all along. He was kind of full of kind of smiles and this amazing kind of expansive openness. And that gave me the idea for starting Noon. So I just had this real insight that I'd had enough of the journalism that I was doing, that I wanted to lean into a different kind of work, a different kind of life. And I wanted to set up retreats at that point and to take people on a kind of midlife journey on retreats. And then, of course, the pandemic happened.
Literally,
so this was just before the pandemic. So then the pandemic happened and I was made redundant from the job that I'd had for 25 years, which was a huge shock, which I'd slightly called in, I think, while I was in Jamaica. And then I really had this opportunity to do the thing that I'd wanted to do. And I'd already got an investor who was really interested in helping me bring this thing to life. So we set it up as a kind of virtual community because it was in lockdown. And we started doing this whole piece of work around how are women in midlife perceived? What are the challenges? What are the issues? And this research that we did was all about what we discovered was this thing we called Forged in Fire for the Queen Ages. So that by 50, over half of women have had at least 5 massive life events.
Yeah.
So divorce, bereavement, redundancy, parents dying or getting sick, maybe a teenager who's also in trouble. We've got an epidemic of mental illness amongst our teenagers here in the West.
Here as well, yeah.
Yes, and then if you chuck into that a bit of your own health problems and a bit of menopause and all of that kind of thing, you get what we call the midlife maelstrom, the midlife cluster, something read if you're a...
Clusterfuck, yes.
I don't know what your rules are, I'm sorry. So yeah, the midlife clusterfuck.
We're all good here. We really live and breathe the Queen Ages, including the language.
So the midlife clusterfuck basically hits everyone. And what I saw around me, my midlife clusterfuck happened kind of at the beginning of the pandemic and So I lost my job, and that was really kind of hard because I've been doing it for so long. And then I got COVID, and then my eldest daughter went off to university.
Yeah.
And I just really felt this kind of massive kind of shift and sadness. And I had to do a whole load of recalibrating and kind of thinking, you know, what I was going to do with my life. And it was very hard at the time. You definitely walk through some darkness around these pinch points of midlife. Yeah. But what I have found myself, and what we also saw in the research, is that when you travel through that darkness, you come out the other side into this amazing sunny uplands. And that is the thing that's really not talked about in our culture. So we hear a lot at the moment, the kind of gloom and doom around menopause or all these terrible things. And it's there in the research that the kind of, I think, unhappiness peaks at 47. There's one of those U curves, and 47 is the kind of lowest point. But it comes back up again. And once you've been through that, I think you really recalibrate in terms of what you really care about, what you really want to do, where you're going to direct your passion, who is on your team and who isn't. And what the women say, in the research, is that we found that the ones who'd been through the most were then the happiest, because they've got their lives set up the way that they wanted them. And I found that to be very true myself. So I now feel, you know, about 1,000,000% happier than I was when I was doing my big job, because I feel much more myself, and I feel much more fulfilled. And I love the work that I'm doing with other women, and the community that we built at Noon, and all these incredible queenagers, and how they support each other, is a kind of inspiration and a delight to me every day. And I also feel like we're doing something really important in trying to change this conversation and make women feel not invisible, and like they go on mattering, and that they've got things to say, and that we can model that also for the women coming up after us. So it's been a real roller coaster of a journey, and I'm not going to undersell the fact that there definitely were some really horrible kind of dark times. But I've also really learned that if you don't go down into that bit of kind of into the darkness, into a bit of regeneration, I read quite a lot of the old Assyrian myths, which is about kind of going down into the underworld. The goddess Ayanna is hung on a hook in the underworld for kind of several months as she kind of regenerates. And if you think about kind of all the stuff about, you know, winter and then turning into spring, we all need a bit of a kind of fallow period to just kind of get ourselves together again, to begin to, for life to kind of reform. And I really felt that happened. And then you come back kind of stronger and knowing exactly what you want to do. I felt a bit like a big plant that had been really pruned back to its essence and then can kind of thrive again. And so I think we all need to think about that midlife kind of clusterfuck as a real opportunity to shed a kind of former skin and kind of take on a new one. And that also, if we're going to go on living for such a long time, those transitional skills of moving out of one incarnation and taking with you all the best, all the amazing things that you've learned and the skills and the experience that you've got, and then kind of metamorphosing those into your next thing, I think is super important. And it's not something that we talk about in the culture. We don't think about flexing those muscles.
Yeah, no, you're right.
But it's not even, it's also the process.
Yeah.
That this is a process, and it's a process which is actually very similar to everyone. And that it's okay to have a bit of time where you take stock and you kind of reboot and you recalibrate, and maybe that's actually quite painful and you lose some things, but also then you work out what's important to you and move forward. And so that is also a very important part of the queenager conversation, I think.
Yeah, it's just so beautiful the way that you've described it. And there was that moment where you said that woman around 47, you're going down. I mean, I literally gasped when you said that, because I believe when I think back now, that was a really dark time for me. And of course, not knowing that I was in perimenopause, that probably didn't help much. I think, you know, they say, you know, knowledge is power. And once you know that something is, it's not just a figment of your imagination, it's a real thing, then you can sort of start to lay the steps to get out of that. And then a whole lot of other stuff came up, which is, do I actually want to be doing this work? Do I want to do something else? Do I want to live in this country? I mean, I was living overseas, and we moved back to New Zealand during the pandemic, and I moved back without a job, you know, after 20 years in Asia building companies, and coming back to having like nobody knows me here, starting from scratch. It was so liberating, but it was liberating because I'd got through the dark times.
Yeah.
And started to really deeply understand myself and know who I was. There's just, I can't even say that 1% of my day is living in doubt now, which is so liberating, like you said. Like, there's no doubts. Of course, I'm not perfect and I make mistakes. I'm constantly learning, but that learning thing is just, is inspiring, you know, to go, oh God, how do you build a website, you know, or what is this digital marketing thing? How is this? And it's so cool to be in this age where you're just curious, like, and you don't judge, you know?
No, I think the ability to go back and learn some whole load of new things.
Yeah.
Because I was so senior at the newspaper that in some ways I've become a bit of an infantilized baby. You know, I never had to do my own social media posts. I never had to book my own taxis. I never booked my own lunch. If I was traveling, I was just given an itinerary. You know, it was quite pathetic. When you start your own company and there's no tech department, there's no one to show you how to do an Insta Live. Actually, my daughters did, my teenagers. You suddenly have to start learning to do a whole load of things that you haven't really done for yourself for years. And I've actually found that to be super empowering.
Yeah.
And I can remember to begin with, I found it absolutely terrifying. So I was so used to having so many people do things for me. But actually now I take huge pride, and I can use something called StreamYard, where you kind of, you know, stream a conversation into LinkedIn and Facebook simultaneously. Yes. You know, and that sounds pathetic, but actually, and I've learned how to use kind of Xero, which is the kind of you know, thing for doing all my accounts. And but I feel a real sense of kind of agency and grip on kind of on my life, and a real can-do mentality, that if I kind of sit down and watch a YouTube video or, you know, ask someone, that I can learn to do something new. And I think that that's also something that people get kind of forget and then get a bit fearful about.
Yeah.
So actually getting stuck in again, I think, is really, really important. And I would really urge anyone who is knowing that they're going into a transition phase to really kind of think about the skills that they might need for that. I just did an article for the Telegraph newspaper here in the UK about your midlife MOT.
Yeah.
And that was looking at all the kind of different bits of one's life and thinking, actually, you do have to, change isn't just going to happen because you click your fingers. Change happens because you actually start doing a whole load of things differently.
Yeah.
And it's hard. And you have to kind of get stuck in, but it's also amazingly kind of rewarding and energizing to really be doing the thing that you care about every day, and to be really in charge of your own life and your own destiny. And we, again, in our research, we see that massively. So we also see this sense in the women's thinking, you know, I've been looking after everybody else for the last kind of 25, 30 years. This is my moment to do something for me before it's too late. And a great sense of at 50 of what I call self-actualization, that really becoming the person you always wanted to be, and having and doing that in quite an intentional way. So I also see a lot of women who are going, yeah, well, I've been working in business for 25 years, but actually what I always wanted to be was a stand-up comedian. Or actually got a friend who's gone back and retrained as a doctor because she'd always wanted to be a doctor. Or I just think there's that real sense of, it's not too late to do the thing. If you do it now, if you wait another 20 years, it probably is too late. So, and there's that real slight drumbeat, I think, at this midlife point, which is, okay, all those dreams that I had as a younger woman or whatever, if they're going to happen, it's now. You know, get on with it, seize the day. And that I think is a really important message. So I would say that there's a series of pinch points, but then that gives you the opportunity to redefine and say, actually, what do I want the next half of my life to look like?
If you haven't yet had a chance to check out my Menopause Management online course, then I have great news for you. This course is now just $27. The course covers all the questions you have on menopause and how to manage and support your symptoms.
Topics include hormonal fluctuations that instigate menopause symptoms, the sleep and stress connection, how to exercise, what to eat, and the importance of a community during this life stage. There is over 2 hours of video content and PDF checklists you can download, including a menopause symptom tracker. This course has had hundreds of participants and has a 5-star rating. The link to the course is in the show notes.
I want to get quickly onto some questions from the Menopause Collective New Zealand. So we are a gang of queen ages. Right. That have come together around the conversation of midlife, leadership, health. Menopause is a big thing for us, so we are called the Menopause Collective New Zealand. And we are working towards making the conversation around menopause normalized across the workplace, at home, in schools, everywhere. So it's quite a lot of work going on in the background. But and they're huge fans of you, Eleanor. So I have a couple of questions. One is from Kate Billing. She's also the founder of the Menopause Action and Awareness Committee on LinkedIn. So you probably find her there. Her question is, what is your view on the importance of midlife women in the workforce and the impact of gendered ageism that diminishes their potential or sees them leaving or feeling stuck? So you've kind of grazed through some of that with your own personal story, but yeah, what's your view on that now? What are you seeing?
Well, I think what we're seeing at the moment is what has been what I term a kind of second brain drain. So I just interviewed the global chair of the 30% Club, which is the biggest global campaign to try and get more women into leadership. She's called Hanneke Schmitz. She's the CEO of a big American merchant bank called BNY Mellon. And what she said to me, we were discussing this whole thing about queen ages leaving, and she said, yeah, there's a second brain drain going on. So it used to be that women left the workforce after they came back after parental leave, that they would come back and they go, oh no, this is a nightmare, and the workplaces wouldn't be supportive and they'd leave then. And I think we've got better at parental leave, but what's happening is that the women come back, but at about 45, between 45 and 55, loads of them fall out of the workforce. So Sheryl Sandberg's lot, Lean In, did a big research with McKinsey. They found that for every woman who's made a director, 2 women leave. She called it the great breakup. So we're seeing an exodus of women from kind of corporate roles, corporate jobs. And what we see in our new research is that they are leaving. Well, what they want from their employers is flexibility.
Yeah.
Work with purpose and to feel really valued. What they get is a kind of very old-fashioned male kind of status. And the more senior you get, the more kind of rigid and more of a boys club, I think, the world becomes. That's certainly what I saw as a very senior executive. And I think if you become quite senior and you've been kind of at a company for a long time, you've probably got enough resources to be able to step away and do something else. What we see amongst the queen ages is just lots of them stepping out and either setting up something of their own or becoming consultants or working in a more flexible way or moving into something which is more purposeful and just deciding they can't be dealing with that kind of the macho bullshit of many corporate cultures and stepping away from it. But that is a real problem if we're ever going to get to gender parity at the top.
Yeah.
So that I think that's a real issue, that you still got this damn pyramid where the women are falling out. So we fixed it a bit so they come back after they have kids. But as you get higher and higher up, it becomes, you know, more and more intolerable. And the other thing that we see is queen ages moving from companies which kind of pretend that they care about kind of DEI or flexibility or those kind of things, and moving to companies which actually will allow them to work in a slightly more evolved way. So as ever, the queen ages, our generation, are the kind of point of the spear, I think, in trying to change corporate culture to something which looks a bit more female shaped. And I think one of the real problems we've had all our careers is we were kind of tolerated. I was listening to something the other day which said, yeah, women were given the lanyard, you know, we were allowed in.
Yeah.
But it was like, okay, you've got equality, you're in the room. And it's like, well.
But then you look around the room and you're 1 of 10, right?
Exactly.
And they think they're doing great. They're celebrating.
Exactly. Yeah, they go, yeah, well, you're in the room, shut up. What more do you want? You go, well, hang on, every single picture on the wall here is a man.
Yeah.
The whole way I'm supposed to act and the whole way this is set up is for a man. Mm. That is not equality. That's kind of the beginning of the road to equality that we've been allowed in the room. And so I think that what's happening at these senior levels is the continuation of that. It's like, okay, well, you're here now. We've given you a place on the board. And so we've now got 40% of women on boards in the UK, but only 16% in those really important executive roles, CEO, CFO, COO, the ones which actually have hands-on levers. So I think there's been quite a lot of window dressing and not really enough change in terms of, I think what happens is the men circle the wagons around the really important kind of, you know, jobs with levers, and the women have kind of been allowed kind of in, but to slightly stand around and kind of spectate. And then if you do get the big job, you very much get the kind of tall poppy syndrome that happened to your amazing Jacinda Ardern, where you're judged in a completely different way from the men. If you try and behave as a leader with some kind of empathy or heart, or try and do it in a different way, you get accused of being weak. I still don't think that we've got any kind of model for a new kind of leadership at the top. And that's why so many women are voting with their feet, and they leave and they go and set up their own thing so they can create an organization where they don't have to behave like an old, you know, dinosaur man.
Yeah. I mean, I can see it happening both in the UK and New Zealand and Australia, that is the case. It's the case here as well. You know, women with really fantastic careers in the C-suite, and then just going, this is not where I want to be. I don't want to hang out here for 8-10 hours a day and flying, zipping all over the place. You're not giving me what I need to be the woman that I am and bring everything that I can, you know, to contribute. Yes. So
and to flourish and to feel like you're kind of living your best life. And I think that there's also something that comes with, you know, with menopause or with midlife or with that kind of wisdom, which is just much less tolerance for kind of being pleasing or just being grateful for being in the room, or you know, just which is kind of what you expected, or applying the kind of social oil, or kind of going, oh yes, what a wonderful idea, you know, and when you've actually heard it 10 times before, it's a bit rubbish. Yeah. You don't really want to have to suck up to some man who knows much less about it than you do. And maybe when you were 25, it felt like a great treat to actually be allowed to do that job. And then you're just like, I've been doing it for 25 years. I just can't face this again.
Yeah.
And I see that so much. And then I think coupled with a bit of menopause stuff. So the Menopause Society in the UK reckon 1 in 10 women leave their jobs because of menopause. Mm-hmm. And to your friend's questions about menopause, I think this is a more nuanced debate. So I'm absolutely delighted that, you know, people like all of you are having this menopause conversation. It's incredibly important. Women deserve HRT if they need it. They deserve the doctor to know what they're talking about. Here in the UK, it wasn't compulsory for doctors to have training in the menopause till last year. I mean, there are some huge bits of health inequity. All that Caroline Criado-Perez has written that brilliant book in The Invisible Woman about how all this medical research is not actually conducted on women's bodies. So I'm not for a second saying that the menopause conversation isn't super important. And I also think for the women who get it really badly, it's really important they have some protections at work and that we all talk about this. However, and it's quite a big but, I find in my community of women at this point, they do not want to be defined as menopausal. Yeah.
That's fair.
Do not want to be offered, you know, hot pink menopausal cream or clothes, which are especially for menopause. Mm. And they don't want to be seen through a menopausal lens, which I think can be very gendered ageist. So we did some research. 80% of the women do not want to be defined as walking hot flushes.
Yeah.
And I think that there's a real problem with that, because what happens is the only conversation around older women now it can feel is this menopause conversation. So if I say to people, I'm talking about queen ages, and they go, oh, menopause. And I go, well, no, I think menopause is one piece of the jigsaw of this midlife clusterfuck when all these different things hit in. And to say that that's all menopause, I think is wrong. And so that while we absolutely need the right treatment, I think it can be quite pernicious to put women back into a biological box. For me, the point of feminism was to free women from their biology. In our 20s, you know, we all get hit on because they think we're hot. In our 30s and 40s, everyone thinks we're about to have a baby.
Yeah.
And what I don't want is for, you know, then you get to 50 when actually, for a lot of women, you're quite free from a lot of those obligations in a way that you kind of haven't been all the way through your kind of womanhood years, and then to be put in a menopausal box of crazy hot flushes, you know, over emotional. So I think it's really important that we talk about this, but I also want there to be much more visibility for women at this point, and we celebrate them for all the incredible things that they're doing. We don't just talk about the fact that they're menopausal. Do you see what I'm saying?
I completely understand.
I think it's really important.
Yeah, I do. When I think about that personally, because I'm in the menopause space quite a lot now,
yes,
and doing lots of education on it, right, and providing support and ideas in the
which
workplace.
Which is great.
But I come from a place of this is, it's a moment, you know, that happens for you, but it's not the end. Like, I'm not about the pity party.
No.
Okay.
No.
So here's some things that we want to do, and then we're going to move forward with the tools and the resources that we now know. I think I lean towards what you're saying, Eleanor, about not pigeonholing women.
Yes.
And giving them another reason to get away with underperformance, because we know that we're capable. We know we can do it. There's going to be glitches along the way, and just have a level of understanding is ultimately what we want, right? And that's the same as when, you know, you're pregnant at work, just a level of understanding.
Yeah.
You know, but I'm going to do the job and I love what I do. So
I'm good at what I do.
Yeah.
And I think, of course, it's really important that there are protections. So, I mean, for the culture of women who have really bad, say, mental health problems or feel really terrible, they should be protected. But it was interesting, I did a big I do a noon circle with my queenagers every month, and they all kind of come, and so we had about 25 of them in the room last week, and we were talking about bodies and about sexuality actually, and they all got jolly cross about being labeled menopausal, and a lot of the women were now beyond menopause and were saying, what if, you know, menopause happened to, it was kind of like a few years, and now I'm out the other side of it. And they were saying, actually, I feel physically better now than I ever have. One woman was saying she'd had the best sex of her life. That there's this kind of vision in the culture that on the other side of menopause, you're a kind of dried up prune.
Yeah.
And actually, that's really not the case. That these women were like super vigorous and kind of, you know, happy and healthy and doing amazing things. So I also think that menopause is something that you kind of pass through, and then there's also a whole great bit of life the other side. So I also think in just pigeonholing women as menopausal, when that's something, it's like a kind of gateway, and then there's a whole other bit, is again kind of neglecting that kind of wisdom or the kind of value of those older women beyond that. So I just think gendered ageism, like misogyny, mutates. So you think you're kind of pushing on something which is going to make things better, and then it's kind of used as another kind of label to define or to kind of traduce women. And I think it's really important that we keep making the case for all the incredible things that women are doing at this point.
Yeah, yeah. Thank you so much, Eleanor. I have another question, and this will be the last one from me. So it's from Jeanette Coey-Perkinson. She was one of the original guests on my podcast way back when we started talking about menopause support in the workplace, and she's a huge fan. Her question is, how do you recommend we move the dial on New Zealand brands to focus on over 50s, such a large market that is currently ignored? And I think that this is probably based on what you're seeing in the UK. How are we kind of making women over 50 feel seen when it comes to, you know, branding products and stuff? So this is quite an interesting conversation. Love to hear your thoughts.
Yeah, it's really important. So part of that was a big bit of the research that we did with Noon, was looking at brands. So I think one of the most interesting figures that we came up with was 63% of queenagers say they would be way more likely to buy from a brand that represented them.
Yeah.
50% feel completely unseen. And about 70% of the women said, for instance, they'd be really interested in buying an electric car, but no car manufacturers are targeting kind of women at this point. And there's a huge opportunity missed here. So Forbes magazine calls teenagers super consumers.
Yeah.
In the UK, they're behind over 90% of all household consumer spending decisions, because I mean, I'm sure you know this yourself, you're buying stuff not just for you, but maybe, you know, for your husband, for your partner, for your kids, for your parents.
Yeah.
So the kind of queenager spread is massive. And also women are 50, I mean, my kids are 20 and 18, but I come across lots of women who've got like a 3-year-old at 50 or an 8-year-old. So we've also got kind of younger kids.
I have a 10-year-old, yeah, and an 18-year-old,
yeah. So you never know kind of where people are on that kind of mothering spectrum, or indeed if they're mothers at all. So nearly 30% of the women here in the UK don't have children. And again, they're never talked about. They were a really interesting kind of subset in our research, because they said to me, I've talked to a woman who's a partner in a law firm here in London, and she said, I'm 50, I'm single, I don't have children. She said, I'm disposable income-a-rama, because she's earning a lot of money as a lawyer. She said, not a single brand ever targets or represents her. And she said, I feel completely invisible to brands. Now, that strikes me as completely bonkers. You know, we're in the middle of a recession. Those women particularly have got a lot of money. You know, other women with family have got big spending power, and yet it's vanishingly small, the number of brands who are actually targeting us directly. They've tried to sell us Tenor incontinence pants and maybe a bit of life insurance, and that is it. I mean, we're beginning to get the odd older woman pop up in some adverts here. We've got Judi Dench kind of doing something about kind of saving people money, but it's pretty piecemeal. I mean, since George Floyd, every single advert here in the UK is a kind of rainbow nation, which, you know, which is great.
Yeah.
But the bit of diversity and representation in advertising, which is always forgotten, is age, is older women. Partly, I think, because we're going back to that male lens piece of using women to brighten up a page or kind of make it look pretty.
Yeah.
You think back to the way cars have been sold forever with kind of, you know, blondes draped across the bonnet, or, you know, there's such a kind of push on that, and the whole marketing advertising media industry is so, you're talking about the fitness culture being so youthified. I think there's also a kind of culture of youth and always trying to target younger consumers, which is crazy because it's the older women who have got the money. So there are some travel brands and things which are beginning to think about this, but I think that there's a huge opportunity. When I interviewed Sheryl Sandberg, the ex-COO of Facebook, she said to me, these women are the most underserved and lucrative cohort in the whole of the marketing spectrum. And so I think it's a real open goal, but it's incredible how reluctant brands and particularly media agencies are to actually feature kind of real queenagers in their advertising. There's a few noticeable exceptions. I was on the tube the other day in London.
Maybe Dove
huge...
and L'Oreal. I've seen some.
Not many old people.
I guess with Dove, I don't know whether it's just that I'm seeing it down here, and I think that's probably some Australasian branding. But yeah, that was one of the first times I remember seeing Dove, and they often line up their ladies because they have different body shapes as well. But
they've done body representation, but I don't think they've done age.
I've seen something. Yeah.
Okay. Well, maybe down under, but not up here. There's a brand called HSBC, big bank. They had done three kind of older kind of grannies with surfboards, which I really liked.
Yeah.
And it was the whole thing about not having to pay fees on your kind of spending money. So I mean, maybe you're slightly ahead of the curve where you are, but
no, I just only gave one example.
Yeah. Okay.
You know, it's the only thing I saw. It's like, okay, the rest is in a desert.
Yeah, it's not great, which is crazy. I mean, I thought when I first started researching this, and when we first got our big piece of research back, I thought that the sheer weight of evidence of the spending power of the queenager market would be all we needed to get brands to kind of, you know, unlock their coffers and start pouring it into kind of queenager advertising or queenager thought leadership. I have not seen that happen yet.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah,
here at Nin, ready to help you speak authentically to queenagers. I'm a great storyteller, but we are not seeing a massive influx into trying to talk to older women.
Yeah, no, I agree. I saw that Forbes article about the spending power of women, and that was a couple of years ago, and I'm actually really surprised that here we are having this conversation, and I really don't think that the dial has moved significantly.
I think it absolutely hasn't. And I'm quite amazed by that. But then when you actually go into some media agencies, which I do quite a lot, there was a big research by Marketing Week, which was, I think it found that that like the average age in the media agency is kind of early 30s, and only 6% of the workforce are over 50, and only 2% of are over 50 and female. So it skews so young, and they're so not even thinking about us that I just don't think we're on the radar. I've just been part of a big research project of a couple of the big media agencies who are trying to kind of talk about the power of the older spending kind of demographic. And there's some people called the Silver Marketing Association who are kind of global thing, who are trying to, because often when you look at companies' campaigns, they don't have a bracket. They just, it just says over 50. So they kind of put us all in the same bracket. And my mum is 80, you know, her needs are quite different from mine. And yet we're all lumped in together. Although that's where the vast majority of the wealth is being held. I think people over 50 control 60% of the wealth and appear in less than 12% of advertising.
Yeah. Crazy. Well, someone's got to wake up. Maybe they listen to this podcast episode and realize, got to get on top of that. My last question, I said the last question was my last question, but this one is from our collective, is like, when are you coming to New Zealand? I know that you do events. We will host you.
I'd love to come to New Zealand. I've never been. I've got as far as Bali. I've been to kind of Bali in Indonesia and traveled
nice
all the way around there.
Nice little stop off.
I've never been to New Zealand. So no, I'd love to come. Maybe when my book comes out next year.
Yes.
I will come, because it's going to have a global, it'll have a global launch. So
okay.
I'll come then.
Yeah, put New Zealand on one of the stops, and you know, would love to host you and be there for the launch of your book. That would be amazing.
Oh, brilliant. Well, thank you. Thanks so much for having me on. And it's so interesting to hear about what's happening in New Zealand as well. And if anyone's interested in what we're doing at Noon, it's noon.org.uk. And I write a weekly newsletter as well on Substack called The Queenager.
Yes. So I'll put all of that in the show notes. So yeah, I've completely stalked you for a while. We're good.
Excellent. No, I'm really glad to. It's great to hear that this is a kind of a global Queenager movement. We need all hands to the pump.
Yeah, we're here, and looking forward to seeing more of what you're doing in the future. And I will report back in future podcasts as well.
Okay, brilliant. Thank you so much. Really lovely
Thanks,
to talk
Eleanor.
To you.
Nice to meet you.
Take care.
See ya.
Cheers. Bye.
See ya. If you aren't a fan of shopping, but you're okay with online shopping and you like to look into recommendations from trusted sources, then check out my shopping lists that I host on Benable. Benable is an online store that lets you save items that you use and you can recommend to others all in one space. I've got shopping lists for menopause products, tools and resources that I use to build my business, healthy foods I love to eat, and travel recommendations. Setting up your own online store is by invite only. So I've added my invite code in the show notes. It's a bit addictive and heaps of fun. Did I forget to mention that it's also a great way to share your affiliate links so that when a shopper buys from your store, you get a cut of the sale, all because you recommended it. So check out Benable. Thanks for listening to today's episode. I'd love to hear what you thought, so feel free to answer in the questions in Spotify or give your feedback in Apple Podcasts, and follow the podcast so you'll receive notifications for new episodes. And stay sexy.